You could say it was a kick in the stomach that started me on my domestic career in this little Saskatchewan town. And the next morning, I left my husband with clothes enough to keep warm. That is, I had a skirt. I had come to the family that had come to the family in Rokenville from relatives in Moose Jaw, where my uncle was a CNR baggageman and considered by us to be rich. That skirt, in my present mind's eye, still looks neat and even nifty. Fitted close to my narrow thighs, it was a soft beige knitted fabric with two short inverted pleats in front, causing motion and eye appeal. My one sweater was really attractive since it was unique in style. The wool color was described by, on the label as Spanish tile, rather elegant, deep maroon. My galoshes, wool underwear, brown boucle winter coat with dyed rabbit fur trim, and small brown felt hat were a carryover from the husband days when, for the first and only time in my life, I'd gone out on the urging of friends and charged those items to a store in his name. Considering I had no money and a prairie winter's temperature, it was necessary. How I got a job. I can't remember who told me about the Reverend and Mrs. So-and-so. Faced with being a hired girl or not eating, I let it be known that I was available. Right away, I got two offers. I was well known in that little town as a soprano soloist at both United Church and in public concerts. The school inspector's wife sang alto to my soprano, so we were on a friendly basis. She and her husband were to go to Ontario for a holiday in May, and of their family, two teenagers were still at home. When I told her I had two offers, she deferred to the Anglican minister's wife, since they didn't need me just yet. So I went to the Anglican house, and in retrospect, it's interesting to note how Mrs. Anglican minister treated me, knowing that I had some other work to go to. My God, what would it have been like if I had had nowhere to go? Maid of all work was no loose job classification in those days. It was a locked-in condition, because the hired girl was expected to do every and any kind of work pertaining to feeding and cleaning humans, house and livestock. If you carried water, it was natural and necessary to carry it out from the bedroom, the bathroom, the kitchen, or any other spot where living and working conditions occurred. Furthermore, the hired girl slept there. She was the employer's prisoner. No chance to sleep in, and no government-run scheme for supplemental income if let out. So Mrs. Anglican minister explained that she actually wanted the house cleaning done in addition to other work. Her morning tea would be brought to her bed by the Reverend, who would put their tiny terrier pup in bed with her. The hired girl would be up, of course, keeping the kitchen stove properly drafted to produce boiled eggs, toast, and more tea, as well as a stove reservoir and a tin boiler, capacity at least 7 pails of water, full of hot water. Dishes, people, walls, floors, and clothing required that amount of water and more. Kitchens are cozy, friendly areas in one's home, but to the hired girl, every new kitchen is like finding that you've met someone you daren't trust. Instinct won't help. Knowledge of dozens of other kitchens are of no real help. If the woman who's hired you is reasonably kind, that makes a difference. But Mrs. Anglican minister was not kind, nor did she ever try to be. Dishes were washed in a shallow enameled metal wash basin. And when potatoes, carrots, etc. were prepared, the wash basin served, as it did when I went upstairs to wash walls. Mrs. Anglican minister used her funds for the tea table, not for the unseeable kitchen. Hired on a monthly basis, but unexpectedly, the Reverend got word that they were to be transferred, and washing ceilings, walls, woodwork and floors, getting meals and cleaning up is so dreary that anything else seems preferable. I asked Mrs. Anglican minister, need I stay? Years after, I still wonder why that woman kept me on, because she knew they were transferring. From that time on, she treated me with more obvious contempt than previously. When someone called, I was expected to stop cleaning, make tea, and serve her and her guest as though I were horribly low caste, though Mrs. Anglican minister was aware that I enjoyed a community-wide reputation as a singer. One morning, I'd been called downstairs to get dinner ready and was peeling potatoes in the wash basin when I answered a knock at the back door. Mrs. Anglican minister sat in the dining room and could have answered the door. I suspect she rather liked to have callers presented to her. This caller was a nice-looking young man, a salesman. He began, or we began, a conversation, which lasted only a couple of minutes, when Mrs. Anglican minister called out, ordering me to stop talking and usher in the young man, whom she hadn't seen, in to see her in the parlor. Embarrassed but aware of her rights, I asked the fellow to follow me, and in his presence the grand dame angrily and with pomposity said I should get on with the dinner and the wall, floor, and woodwork washing, topping it off by shutting the door with force between me in the kitchen and she and the young man in the living room. Embarrassed, yes, enraged damn well. Some few tears fell on the potato peelings, and they catalyzed and crystallized my benumbed psyche. The salesman had left by the front door. I knew a middle-aged couple who had a spare bed and were kindly. Potatoes still lay in the wash basin, only partly ready for the pot. I'd had not $1 of pay. Perhaps Mrs. Anglican minister thought I'd put the potatoes on to boil, because it wasn't till I'd put what I owned into my only carry-all, that old flannelette sheet, and walked out the front gate that she realized I wasn't there. With her plain, mean face pulled back as though her bun of hair was stretching the skin over her bones, she shoved open the front door, yelling at me, Mrs. M., I expect those potatoes to be ready for dinner. Courage, or some dormant instinct for survival, not of the body but of the spirit, made me find my voice, not easily. I called back, wanting more to cry than speak. In that case, Mrs. Anglican minister, you'll have to do them yourself. I didn't see her again. The Reverend looked me up and paid me for the exact number of days I'd been hired as hired girl.
Mrs. Scott's diary. This is 1935. Okay, we were talking before that about Mine Mill. You were about to say something about Mine Mill and I turned off the tape.
Oh, I was just horrified all through that fight because I was close to the situation, working for the Vancouver Labour Council and then later on for the Steelworkers Union in Vancouver, but aware of what was going on in Trail.
As secretary for the Labour Council and the Federation, what kind of work did you do?
Oh, purely office work.
Right.
Did a little speaking here and there. And.
What would you speak on?
On women. Women's rights. That's when I was on town meeting of the air with another woman who was a community worker and a well-known Roman Catholic.
What kind of position on women's rights would you represent? Was it one which the Federation held, or was it you?
I would have to say it's one they gave token interest in. But that's what it amounted to, was token only.
So what kind of things would you speak about in terms of women's rights?
Well, the right of women to earn as much as a male. Mm-hmm. I was really hurt when my boss and the secretary of the Labour Council said to me after a meeting where my wages were voted upon as well as his, and they upped yours another $30 after Huey Allison made an emotional speech. And I said, did you resent that? Well, we had already agreed to give you $20. And he was annoyed that I had been granted a higher rate of pay. He got $50 at that same meeting. Right. $50 raise.
Yeah.
And he's a remarkable man. He's now the labor attaché in London, England, and went to Kenya and worked with the then unknown Tom Mboya. People came over on the good ship Hector in the 1600s to Canada, and he's a real good socialist. But I mean, what I'm trying to say to you is that even his attitude at that time was women really shouldn't be claiming the same rates of pay and or equality in every area.
So there was the issue of income and equal pay. Were there other issues that you spoke on?
Oh, I think so. I think it was very difficult for a woman to get elected to a position in the trade union movement. And if she did, she was almost a freak. It was so unusual.
Why?
Well, simply because she was a woman, and it was just considered that we were in a world of patriarchy, and also that we were upstarts if we tried to change the status quo.
Were there women who tried to get elected to positions in the union?
Oh, yes.
What
happened
to them?
Yes, there have always been. Oh, they went faded into oblivion, mostly.
Mm-hmm.
Or, like myself, are too old to get into anything now. Josephine Halleck was resented because she would vote against. I remember one time the Labor Council, and this is a little less than 15 years ago in Vancouver, it required unanimous vote for something. Can't remember what it was. And Jo held out, and she was the only person who did. And the men resented bitterly. And yet, she was one of the most honest people I have ever known and really believed what she was doing was right.
Yeah. Okay. What about other women who were in the leadership, like Eileen Soufrin?
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel that there was... that it was difficult for them to receive the recognition?
Oh, absolutely. Eileen carried on not an overt, but a running battle that people knew about in the whole Steelworkers Union. As a matter of fact, Bill Mahoney and Larry Sefton, two very powerful people in the United Steelworkers, wrote to David J. McDonald asking that he consider giving her equal pay with other representatives because she was doing representatives' work, bargaining with John Inglis and all big firms and signing good contracts and doing organizing and had done a job that nobody else could be trusted to do, that is, try to organize Eaton's. And David J. McDonald refused to give her equal pay, and she resigned.
In protest over this?
Yes.
Right. Were there other ways in which the kind of work she was doing, you know, was not really fully recognized by the unions, do you feel?
No, that's the main thing I know about. She was always very active in the CCF and the NDP. I don't know whether she ever sought a nomination, but she would have been an excellent mm-hmm. candidate, but she never got a nomination.
Right, okay. Also, you talked a bit about childcare, daycare.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you were involved in...
Well, I had to raise a child. With out any so-called daycare, although my mother came to my rescue when my son was about 7, and she said, that's how I moved to BC, she said, mm-hmm. come out to Vancouver, there are jobs, and I'll keep an eye on your child while he goes to school, because I had to work in Vancouver and live in Burnaby. We could afford to live in Burnaby easier than Vancouver. And without my mother's help. But I was aware all the time of the extra burden that women had, not just in the welfare of their children under a mother's care, but also the difference it meant to children in their daily life with their peers, their schoolmates, mm-hmm. and their other friends, when there was a mother at home, or someone.
Yeah.
Caring for them. And I saw and still see adequate daycare as meaning the difference between a liberated woman with children and one who is tied down. Because believe me, even if you don't keep them clean and fed all the time, there are still so many things to do for a child.
Mm-hmm.
And they need that.
Right. Okay. Was daycare an issue that came up at all within the labor movement?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
I have given you a photograph of myself arguing vociferously and continuously on that in the BC Federation of Labor. And I must say that I got a better response than I expected. The reason that I was pleased to get that response was that I noticed men were glad to hear about it. They had never thought about it. And after I spoke, I was asked by a number of delegates to tell them more about it. It just hadn't ever contemplated what it would mean for women to be able to have a careful and educated supervision for children outside the home.
Right. What year was that you were speaking on daycare?
That year must have been 1966.
Okay. Was there any discussion of daycare before then at all?
No.
No. So that was just when it was beginning
mm-hmm.
to
mm-hmm.
come up. And did women in the OTEU talk at all about daycare as an issue in terms of anxieties about taking care of their children? And
I don't recall
yeah.
Anything, if at all, of that kind of talk.
Were there other issues that I guess, in a sense, might be specifically women's issues that came up within the union, like maternity leave?
Mm-hmm. Yes. They were hooted at first.
Oh, yeah? By who? By everyone?
The men, you know. What do you girls, you know, quote, girls, think you're going to get? And they were just as difficult to bargain with as anybody. As a matter of fact, I think they were harder to bargain with because, in actuality, it's still easier to negotiate with someone of, I don't want to say superior intelligence, but I mean someone with the kind of native intelligence that allows for humanitarian view while they're negotiating all the various things that go with a union mm-hmm. contract.
Right. Did you achieve maternity leave at all in your contract?
A little bit in the beginning. Right. Not the maternity leave with pay
right.
and that is okay. now obtained.
But no loss of seniority, that kind
yeah.
of thing. Mm-hmm. And do you think that some of the things that OTU achieved or the women working for the trade unions achieved had any kind of spillover or effect on demands that went into the union contracts?
Mm-hmm. I do.
Okay, can you talk about that a bit?
Well, I felt that any time negotiations went on for female categories in a mixed operation, that is male and female, that I really felt that negotiators from the union side were glad to be able to say, the women in so-and-so are getting this,
mm-hmm.
and used us as a yardstick.
That's interesting.
Yep.
Yeah.
We were blacklisted as far as getting jobs with places like BC Electric or big companies. You know, you didn't go from a union office to an office in the private sector. At least I don't know anybody that did.
Right, because they would be afraid that you'd organize.
That's right.
Or demand those conditions.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You probably would, too. You said also that you had been involved in organizing a choir when you worked for the Labor Council.
Mm-hmm.
Did you organize social activities generally?
Oh, mm-hmm. yes. That's my forte, is people. You know, I like working with people. I probably, if I'd had the opportunity for further education, likely I'd have gone into teaching first and then evolved into more of other things, because I still like to do that kind of thing. That's probably why I'm president of the local council of women and have been mm-hmm. with business and professional women's club, etc.
Were you involved in any particular strike situation?
Oh, heavens, yes. I've had this organized workers walk through a picket line that I'm standing on and singing Solidarity Forever at the top of my lungs.
When was this?
About 1970, and there I was. I took time off from my job at the IWA to be on the OTEU picket line down on one of the iron companies. Opal Skilling could tell you about that. And it was a legitimate strike, where the company had an office in one location and an office in another location. And one Monday morning, the people came, and there wasn't anything but a telephone sitting on the floor. That's how they got out of saying, we don't have to negotiate with these employees. There is no one at that location anymore.
So people put up a picket line?
Well, the picket line had been up before that. But as I tell you, it's a pretty bitter thing to stand on a picket line shouting your lungs out at a group of men standing there that you don't want to go to work.
And they were in the union?
They were in the steelworkers union. They walked through our picket line.
And what do you think that part of why they did that was because it was women who were?
No, there was an argument there about whether we had a right to continue that picket line, but we had a legitimate right to be there, and we wanted to keep that plant from operating.
Shut down, huh?
Yep.
Were there
it wasn't yeah. always like that. I got wonderful support, and so did. I shouldn't say I mean the OTEU got good support many times through the BC Federation of Labor from other unions. But it hurt when you mm-hmm. didn't get the support you felt you should.
How about the IWA? You worked for them?
Mm-hmm. Nearly 14 years.
Right. And were you there in 1946?
In 1946, no. I was with the Packing House Union right. and retail wholesale. But in 1948, this big split developed, right. and other unions came to the rescue of the IWA, and I churned out leaflets night and day then, because, in fact, I just left my work for mm-hmm. a whole week with the Packing House and retail wholesale and did nothing but keep that old mimeograph machine going.
And what was this around? This was around the fight inside the union?
This was where the white bloc of the IWA, which had huge membership in Vancouver and New Westminster, they had to have help in getting their point across. And I was with the so-called white bloc and turned mm-hmm. out these leaflets. I was told at that time by one of the men in Local 1-217 that they would see that I got paid for all this night work that I did. I have never got paid, nor have I ever sent them a bill.
What were the issues that the White Bloc was taking up in terms of its confrontation?
The only issue was, really, that the Communist Party had decided to dissolve the Woodworkers Union mm-hmm. and form a new union called the Woodworkers Industrial Union of Canada, which spelt W-U-I-C, and they were called the WUIs.
And so the organization was to prevent
yeah.
a split in the union? Is that it?
Oh, and it was a terrible battle.
Mm-hmm.
As if you look into records there, you'll see where the president of the IWA was thrown into a ditch, and there were dreadful fights. People told me that camps were so badly split that families who had been friends for years stopped speaking to each other. They spat upon each other. It was a dreadful thing.
And you worked for the White Bloc. Was this in part because of your previous involvement with the CCF? And
really, it was just the fact that I was working for unions that were mm-hmm. in the White, because I was not involved politically
yeah.
myself. I was a member of the CCF, and of
right.
course opposed to the takeover
mm-hmm.
by the Communist Party, as, of course, the leader of the Communist Party. We've always been told that Nigel Morgan, who was leader, and Harold Prichet, who was certainly the trade union leader then and was also the Secretary-Treasurer of the BC Federation of Labor, did not want to do that, but had orders from above to go ahead and try it. And it split the trade union movement in BC as it has never been split before, and it took years for it to heal.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, I think the IWA only amended their constitution a few years ago to allow communists to be members.
Mm. Okay. Were there other strikes during the 40s that you were involved with at all?
Well, I did mention that nationally the packing house workers went on strike.
Right.
There were also strikes in the retail wholesale union. And at the same time that the packing house workers were out, the steel workers were out right across Canada.
What kind of work would you do around supporting those strikes as someone who worked for the union?
Oh, I did an awful lot of extra office work
mm-hmm.
because strikes meant a lot more work in the office. And if necessary, I would go out and distribute leaflets at the gate.
Right. So you would know people in the unions? And
oh, yes. I think
yeah.
they knew me very well for
right.
a long time.
Okay. And what about your community and family and friends, the sort of social milieu that you were in? Were most of the people you knew involved in the labor movement?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
To a great extent. One of the strange things that I noticed about the labor movement, and it rather saddened me, was that there were echelons within
mm-hmm.
the movement. And when you went to a social event like a dance, you noticed that the president of one union danced with the wife of the president of another union, and that the secretary-treasurer of one union would dance with the wife of the secretary-treasurer of another union. And if you weren't really anything more than the lower ordinary member, you didn't get dancing with the executive.
Hmm.
Some people say that isn't true, but it is.
Right.
It was.
And was there, were there any sort of either formal women's committees or informal groups of women who would spend time together who were active in the labor movement?
The auxiliaries were encouraged as long as all they did was visit the sick and injured member in hospital and give them cigarettes and the local union paper.
Right.
And feed the strikers when there was a strike.
What about other kinds of organization?
No.
Did that happen at all?
No.
No women's committees ever? Did women who were trade union activists spend time together and talk
yes.
at all?
Yes. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Right. We were very honest with each other, too. We knew where we stood. We knew what the cards read.
What kind of things would you talk about or consider?
Well, I think we were very reasonable and intelligent in the way we would study contracts and get contracts from Eastern Canada, where we felt that they were a jump ahead. Or even when I was in the IWA, we always tried to follow the head office of the IWA in Portland, because for some reason or other they were a step ahead of the rest of us. So that I feel that we were constructive mm-hmm. in our meetings. It was too bad that the division of the communist and the more CCF group was mm-hmm. always evident there too. And I think that was a carryover from the IWA bitter battle.
Yeah, and the split in the BC yep. Federation of Labor.
Right.
Right. So you would look at these contracts in order to be able to set sort of, mm-hmm. look at your goals in terms of negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
And, right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm trying to see if there's stuff I didn't cover. Were most of the people who worked for the unions women? Was
oh,
it almost
yes.
exclusively women?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Very few male office people.
Right.
And don't you understand that the reason was that men didn't want to belittle themselves and become mere office workers.
So that was an attitude that
if
was
I'm
really
cynical,
present.
If I sound that way, it's quite natural and quite reasonable that I am, because that's the way we were treated.
Mm-hmm.
As long as we kept our place, I was an upstart, and it's a wonder that I had any male friends. But Joe Morris knew that if he yelled at me, I just yelled back, and we had an understanding.
Right. Okay. And were most of the... So then almost all the leadership people in the union would be women then, within OTU?
Oh, yes.
The whole executive board?
Yeah. But when it came to appointing people to top jobs, they were always men.
That's what I was going to ask next.
This is what burnt me up. You couldn't get... Opal Skilling has got to where she is because at one time a woman quit being our little secretary treasurer, and Opal was out of a job. She'd been fired by the man in that picture at the IWA. And she took it on, and I give Opal full credit. She took it on when there was nothing in it.
Mm-hmm.
And stuck with it, and of course she's got a good job and had a good one for quite some time, and has done a good job, I think.
But in terms of, like, on a national level or international level, there are men who are in the leadership of the OTU?
Absolutely. And when the Canadian Labour Congress presented its brief to the Royal Commission on the Status of Women, and I was a committee person out here, who do you think gave it? Donald MacDonald.
Mm-hmm.
A man gave the brief on the status of women. I was sick.
Mm-hmm. Right. Did the OTU, as a union with a large female component, try and encourage other women in other unions to get mm-hmm. active?
Yes.
What kind of things would you try and do?
Well, to the extent that we had any influence at all, which wasn't very great, we did try to get women in other unions to, or rather in other industries even, to do something. But, and the OTU made a few feeble attempts at bringing in other groups, but I don't know what their membership is now, but I tell you, we never got anywhere.
How would you try and get other women to be active? Do you remember any of the
specific things? We would leafletize now and then. but we didn't have any money to spend. Mm-hmm. And in Vancouver, the Office Employees Union was the BC Hydro. Mm-hmm. They were the big ones, and they were very busy doing their own thing, and we were looked on as a poor relation.
So would you leave it to try and organize?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And did the union have a newsletter?
Yeah. It seems to me that Opal, but when you're talking about a newsletter, do you mean locally? Because we did have an international paper.
Yeah.
Yeah, from Howard Cochran.
But was there like a local paper that might have?
Not very. Yeah. No, I wouldn't say there was a regular one. I didn't see it.
And union discussions would talk about equal pay.
Oh yes.
Maternity
leave.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did people talk a bit about at all about equal work?
Yes. Oh right. Yes. I think that all aspects of the working area were well discussed.
Right. Okay. And about political activity, were most of the women involved in the union and who you ran into who were active unionists involved politically as well, either with the CCF?
No. I was very disappointed all the years I worked in union offices to find that there were very few that wanted to have any political life at all.
Mm-hmm.
I was loaned to the NDP right out of the office. I took my typewriter with me in political campaigns and when I worked for the IWA, which I told you was nearly 14 years, and they would let me go and work actively in a political because they knew how I felt. But I had nobody to talk to about politics during the lunch hour.
You were involved with the CCF.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What kind of work did you do with them?
Anything that they asked me to do.
Right.
Joe jobs are, well, I never got any of the highfalutin jobs.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, I think that the CCF and the trade unions were afflicted to a degree with the same attitude to women as other areas of life. I remember going to a luncheon once when I moved five times because, first of all, Tommy Douglas's wife didn't show up on time, so I was asked to sit in the seat that she was to have, and Grace McGinnis was the speaker, and she hadn't showed up, and I was asked to move then and sit in the seat she was to have, and I did it. I wonder now why I was so willing to do any damn thing they wanted me to do, just to sort of, it's all for the party,
mm-hmm.
And I belittled myself. And probably would have gained more ground if I had stood my ground and said, I'm sorry, I'm here as a person too.
Was there any activity inside the CCF around women's rights?
By women, yes.
What form did it take? What kind of things
did
you
do? Oh, just a little discussion now. Conventions.
Right.
We began talking 15 years ago, bringing things like that up. And there was reasonable support for it as long as nobody had to put their money where their mouth was.
Right. Did that discussion in the CCF affect the trade unions, spill over and affect the trade unions at all?
No. The discussion about women's
rights?
About
women in this, yeah.
And you know, there were excellent women. At
mm-hmm.
one time in the early 40s, there were five CCF women here in the Victoria Legislature. And they were great women. I knew
right.
them. Laura Jameson and Grace McGinnis were two of them whom I know pretty well. And Gladys Webster was another wonderful person, Arnold's first wife. And they were highly respected, too. But like Grace McGinnis said, you had to be twice as smart and work twice as hard to gain the same amount of respect
yeah.
as a woman.
Okay. Are there any women who you feel should be particularly noted in terms of the kind of contribution they made to the labor movement?
Well, of course, Eileen.
Right.
And I think that Josephine Halleck ought to get some sort of recognition.
Mm.
Unfortunately, some of the wonderful ones that you could have known are gone, like Helena Gutteridge. Did you ever hear of her?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. She was a remarkable person. is when I had just acquired enough typing speed to be able to type with two hands, and I did get a job in headquarters orderly room up on 10th Street Hill in Calgary, which was the number 2 wireless and air gunnery school. I was a civil employee. I didn't belong to the women's division of the RCAF. And men ran the show then. There were very few women who were in any official capacity. I do remember an assistant to the adjutant being a Miss Somebody, mm-hmm. but that was the exception rather than the rule. We had nothing to say about our salaries, of course, and I was in a room, probably half a dozen women with 30 men, and we had to work, start work at 8:30 in the morning because it was wartime. We had nothing to say about that either. One thing, we did get 3 weeks vacation, which was way ahead of anything else at that time. I was doing part clerical and part stenography so that as soon as the last message came in to discontinue, or rather the first message came in to discontinue classes, I knew the war was going to be over in a few days. And I quit immediately so that I could go to secretarial school and better my earning ability. The terrible thing about working there, and perhaps this isn't cogent to what you're talking about, but every 6 weeks we graduated 200 young men, and the mortality rate for wireless air gunners was 85%. And I used to see them standing there graduating with the flag going up and the Air Force tune, da-da-da, da. And I'd see that flag and look at those young men and realize that 85% would be dead within a few months.
Did they know the percentages?
Sure.
Did they volunteer for the job? Or?
If they were the volunteers. Yeah. It was the French Canadians who were sent out there as what we call GDs, general duties, that caused terrible trouble on the campus or the area because all the others were in the thing for a matter of life and death, and they were just cleanup men. They didn't have to join. There was a riot there while I was there. The Australians, you see, it was a Commonwealth air training plan, and the Australians and New Zealanders were rebels, and they even burned the efficiency pennant and the flag and took the man who was in charge of the station that night of high rank down to the ring and pummeled him, went down to the guardhouse and freed all the prisoners and tore out the toilets and commandeered trucks and drove wildly through the streets of Calgary. There wasn't a thing in the papers about it.
And what were they protesting? Anything?
They were protesting the conditions. The commander of the station was an English-British army. His name was Owen, and he thought he could treat those fellows like you used to treat people in the British Army. For instance, he'd have a man who'd committed a minor misdemeanor do pack drill with 40 pounds on his back up and down in front of the school for several hours. And they rioted. And, for instance, when he gave a dictum that the Australians were not to wear the Australian hat, the felt hat with one side yep. turned up, very gay-looking thing, gay, they all appeared the very next day wearing their own Australian hat. And the day after the riot, Air Vice Marshal Howson was at the gate with army trucks and said, I hear there's been a bit of trouble up here. At that gate and that gate, there are army trucks. Anyone who is dissatisfied with the Air Force will please just step out and go into the army. And nobody moved. The two people, an Australian and a Canadian, who incited the riot were charged with mutiny, which was punishable by death.
Death. So did they die? Or?
No. Mm-hmm. They were given jail terms.
Jail terms.
But it was very interesting. Okay.
And did the Army at any point deal with the whole question of women coming into the war industry or into the Army during...
Oh, no. They were so... bloody glad that women would do anything, and women were getting pay that was unheard of.
Yeah. So the women were just sort of relieved that they had jobs and
relieved
that they were there.
Mm-hmm.
Were they anxious towards the end of the war that they would not be able to find employment?
No.
Was there any discussion
of that? Yeah. This is why I quit right away. because I was part of the rumblings that were going on about, now what are we all going to do for jobs?
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't even wait for the school to disband. I just quit that week and enrolled in Mrs. Hogan's secretarial school and upped my status considerably in the both earning and prestige.
Do you remember, in terms of press coverage or general articles, anything that referred to the need for women to go back to the home and give up their jobs to the returned men?
No, I don't recall a lot of that. I recall it starting subtly. I don't remember a great wave of that because there were lots of jobs and women just wanted to have babies.
Right. Yeah.
And they sure did. Very much in a sort of non-declarative manner. All her life, she was what we would have called a staunch fellow. And her devotion to what she believed very deeply was more humanitarian than political.
She's like beautiful. A Christian socialist?
Well, yes, she was. She changed her Christian label once or twice. That is, she was born into the Anglican Church. And as long as she ever went to church, although she became a Presbyterian and then united through marrying my father, she would intone the Lord's Prayer rather than just say it, you know, because she was a British background. But she was so true to what she believed and felt that I'm sure I would have felt that I was sinning against her if I hadn't been true to the things that she believed in.
I have one last question, which is that you see yourself as a feminist now.
Oh, heavens, yes.
And does that come out of the experiences that you had in the labor movement and as a woman?
Oh, very much so. In fact, when I went the other day to the arthritis clinic and the lady said, "Are you Miss or Mrs.?" I said, "Would you please put Ms.?" And I got the same repost as I always get. A little kind of giggle. And I just stand on my dignity. I don't try to, sometimes I make a little speech, but most of the time I just insist that I want that category, not for myself, but for all other women.
Do you feel that your consciousness around women's oppression and women's rights has changed and sort of deepened from, let's say, the 1930s or 40s?
No, I can't use the word deepen. It's moderated.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't, mind you, I still flare up far too fast. I have often wished I could be cool, but I can't where the injustice against human beings. Human beings whom I know, and here I have to say this with great feeling, women do have an ability, whether it's God-given or what else, for greater sensitivity, for greater perception to other people's needs and feelings. And I'll die a rabid feminist, because I just can't be any different.